So, you know, I was a fill-in for the person who couldn't come, but I'm happy to be here anyway. And this is actually my very first time at your APHA party. I'm a heart doctor by training and practice. I retired 2 years ago, and for the last 4 years, I've been on the Richmond City Council. And I got to say, I really feel comfortable at APHA. It's amazing to be around so many people that understand social determinants of disease. It's just great, and it's great being in this room. I think I heard the word revolution said 3 times. What was that other great quote from Sophie? Science over ideology. So I came to the Richmond City Council. Well, I came to Kaiser Richmond. I was 32. They made me chief of cardiology, and I already had in my mind that I wanted to work in a place where disadvantaged circumstances gets under the skin and causes premature illness and disease. I just didn't really quite understand how it happened, and I'm still learning how it happened. And in those 30 years, a whole field of social epidemiology evolved, and my daughter is Len Syme's last PhD student, so it's very personal to me as well. And Richmond's been very personal because everything I own in life comes from my job in Kaiser, and Kaiser really is birthed in Richmond. And I really fell in love with Richmond, and I got a couple of my colleagues here, Gabino Arredondo and Jennifer Lee, stand up, say hello. These two young people are the hub of the Richmond health and environmental competency in our city. And we've really developed a lot of that. And when I first came on the city council, I had this idea about, you know, I would use public health science and population health science to inform policy. At that time, I thought the word translation had something to do with languages, but now I know that you use it for this. I'll get to the soda tax in a second, but the first challenge with that was smoking. And I got on council and they said, well, you have an F grade in your smoking ordinances, the American Lung Association. You know, you don't go to medical school and think, oh, F grade, oh my God, I never got an F grade, even I didn't get an F grade in French. So, you know, what do you need to do to get an A grade? Well, you need to have your lawyers rewrite your ordinances. I think we're giving lawyers a good name here, a lawyer who is a bubble master on the weekend. So we did that, but imagine sitting around a table and you're on the table and there's the head of the apartment owners association and the realtor association and all these people who are fighting you and saying, how can you possibly tell people they can't smoke in their apartments? And you're sort of sitting around and you're thinking, okay, we'll phase it in, we'll do 25% of the apartments, and then you have a paper in front of you that says, wait a second, that smoke goes through the vents and goes through the walls, and the person on the other side gets sick, you know, so it's like, well, okay, we do 25% so we don't care about the other 75%. We ultimately are now the model for the state, and we ended up telling people that you can't smoke cigarettes in your own apartment, which at first seemed so draconian to me, but we were really pushed by the data and pushed by what we knew, and that's what we're trying to do with the soda tax as well. Let me introduce you to the city and I love and which I work and which I live now. Richmond has 100,000 people. In 1941, it had 25,000 people. In 1945, it had 120,000 people. That's where Henry Kaiser built the ships, and people came from Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Black and white people came, lived in tents, built the ships, and had a pretty good life because these were pretty good paying jobs. And when the war ended, we lost the ships and we lost building the tanks. And we've been in a pretty much of a depression since. We've got about, I don't know, 15% unemployment. So in a city of 100,000 people, that means you need to provide jobs for 9,500 people, which is a payroll of $950 million a year that you'd have to bring in if everybody had a $50,000 a year job and $50,000 for benefits. So that's the city in which we live. But we also have a health problem. I have to confess, I was a cardiologist for 30 years. I never really knew where fructose was metabolized or really thought a lot about sodas or this connection. But it was clear to me in working in the community that obesity and the attendant diseases that went with it, like diabetes, premature heart disease, what became metabolic syndrome, were all flourishing in Richmond. I just had the wrong idea. I thought you got fat and then that predisposed you to other diseases. It's not really how it works. It all happens at the same time, but I'm not sure how much of the physiology you're interested in or the pathophysiology or how much we have time to go into. But what we found in Richmond is we have a lot of fat kids, and it's a health disparity issue because it's a third of our African American and a third of our Latino fifth and seventh graders are obese, and another 20% in each group are overweight. And we know from what our public health director told us, these kids are going to die young. They're going to die of complications of diabetes. In fact, every major cause of death now is linked to sugar-sweetened beverages. Whether it be complications of diabetes, premature heart disease, strokes, or cancer, or complications of hypertension, there is a definitive link to sugar and sugar-sweetened beverages. But we had this data, and then the challenge was, well, if you don't do anything, Richmond becomes 42% obese when these kids grow into adulthood. It's 24% now. So I've been going around saying, well, you know, when you've got this much chronic disease, because these 42% are going to have chronic disease, you know, they're not going to volunteer to coach the Little League and teach the Sunday school and all those things that I've learned about from all you about these terms, social capital and social cohesion and so on, begin to be a problem and your city begins to fray. But I had Dr. Kristen Bibbins-Domingo say, yeah, but how about the fact that they won't be working either? And basically your economy depends on young people working, and they won't be. So that's the challenge we're up against. And we know that we're all getting fatter. It doesn't matter what age group you're in. We're supposed to look like this. And Marion, I think I got this idea from one of your slides, but we're now looking like this. And this is our evolution. And, you know, this is humorous, but it also introduces that idea of evolutionary biology, which is at the key of this. We are not who we pretend to be, right? I mean, we are physiologically hunter-gatherers, pretty much. I mean, we can digest milk. I think that's the only difference. You know, so and the soda is key in there, because think about a hunter-gatherer, gathering, fruits and tubers and so on, and then bringing a little water and going on the hunt, and they go long distances to hunt, right? Well, you eat a little, and then you what happens when you eat? You get an insulin response, right? And then you're running in the hunt, you get thirsty, you drink a little water. You don't get an insulin response. Drink a Coca-Cola, you would. Between our kids eating breakfast and lunch, breakfast is usually a Coca-Cola and Cheetos, and, whatever at lunch, there's two or three Cokes in there. No wonder the pancreas is getting tired, right? It's supposed to be sleeping during that time. And we all know that at the root of it is we're eating too much sugar. And let me just make a distinction for you between liquid sugar and solid sugar. When I get thirsty, I never reach for a donut. Never. I don't eat donuts anyway, but, and nobody does. You reach for a beverage. If you think of every man in this room knows that when you go to the men's room, there's a urinal. We know that the waste streams are different of solid and liquid. If you think about it, the organs are different. Kidneys got nothing to do with digestion. You don't need pancreatic juice to digest a soda. You don't need hydrochloric acid. Your body is, for 150,000 years, rehydrated itself with water. Now all of a sudden we're rehydrating ourselves with what was on the last slide, right? It's just water with 15 teaspoons of sugar mixed in. It gets absorbed immediately. There's no digestion. What's in that sugar? What are those two sugars? It's glucose and fructose. Marion Nestle taught me that it doesn't matter that it's high fructose corn syrup. Sugar is sugar. Sucrose is 50-50. High fructose corn syrup is 45-55. But the two sugars, think of what they do together. Glucose, you get that big insulin response. Fructose, right to the liver, turned into fat. Okay? And this is where it's not about you get fat and then other things happen. The same time that your liver is making, or our children's livers after they drink the big gulp, and making the fat that we see on in their cheeks and their double chin and around their waist, it's making fat that's packing their organs, including their liver. It's making small, dense LDL particles that are packing their coronary arteries. It's making triglycerides, which are promoting coronary disease. That fatty liver, that this generation of kids, when they grow to adulthood, the leading at least this is what Rob Lustig told me, the leading cause for liver transplant will be soda. Will be kids who got fatty liver and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease from that. Long before that happens, the liver becomes insulin resistant, pancreas starts shouting, putting out more insulin. That's where the diabetes comes from. So these are just some of the medical data that linked sugar-sweetened beverages. I took most of these slides out because I only have 10 minutes. But let me just show you a couple of recent ones, very big study. You all know about the nurses' study, right? Well, when they looked at it in terms of diet, basically if you're drinking a can of soda a day, you're going to get a heart attack. Okay, MI is doctor talk for heart attack, right? And this study came out this year, okay, March 12th this year. So this is part of the challenge for doing this enrichment. Okay, I'm a cardiologist. I have to confess, true confession, I don't read circulation regularly, but I did read this article because it came with an American Heart Association press release. But this article says that your risk, if you're a man, of regular consumption, a can a day, leads to a 20% risk increase for a heart attack. And all the markers that go along with producing a heart attack go up as well. So what does that do to the idea that any food or beverage could be part of a balanced diet if you just would balance it somehow? I mean, there is no way to balance this. That's what this is saying. Now, since nobody in Richmond has read this article but me, how do we bring this health information into the community in a way that can inform them so they can make a real informed decision on the soda tax? That's a challenge for us. But all of the data is in our favor. And there are different ways to do the messaging. New York City, very, very aggressive messaging from Dr. Thomas Farley. The soda turns into a mental fat, supposed to make you get disgusted, I think. We adopted this from New York City. We took a map of Richmond because, you know, one of the pushbacks we got is, oh, there's no PE in the schools, which is not true, but no PE, you know, when I was a kid, I used to, you know, do this, that, and the other. No wonder I'm not fat and our kids are. One soda, you got to walk 3 miles. So we drew a map in Richmond from one of our communities, Parchester Village to Kaiser Richmond, and we showed people, that's where your kid has to walk, you know, if they're going to burn off that soda. So it's not about, you know, there's no way to exercise this stuff off unless you're a super athlete. We weren't the first ones to come up with the soda, with the tax idea. Here's an article that Kelly Brownell did in the New England Journal. Thomas Farley is the public health director for New York City, and all the rest of them are superstars in this field. And there's plenty of data that's showing that the tax will decrease consumption. They're all computer models because nobody really knows. If we pass it, we'll be studied. Robert Wood Johnson will come and study us. But the American Beverage Association did a survey in Richmond, and their survey showed 20% decrease in consumption, actually 15 to 24. Everybody on the medical side is on our side except for Dr. Pepper. But basically, the California chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics wrote a letter in support saying that they, quote, applaud the Richmond City Council on behalf of the health of the children of California and strongly support this measure. So, but we get a lot of pushback, and, you know, head of the CDC, who I guess came on by webinar, the opening session, had a great quote in our favor. And part of what pushed us in Richmond was the kids don't have enough soccer fields, they don't have enough baseball fields, and they came, the grassroots coalition, saying, we want you to push this because we want the money. We want soccer fields, we want our kids to, we got 3,000 kids in after-school sports, we got 10,000 who are not playing, we want them in there. So that was part of the impetus. The pushback, of course, is this is regressive, right? Hurts the poor people. Do you know where that comes from, that line? It comes from Big Tobacco. Stan Glantz pointed that out for us. So, and they have circulated in Richmond, and it's stuck with a lot of people. You know, I mean, we are trying to explain to people that the average family would pay 20 cents a day and that nobody would have to pay the tax. You could do a radical thing like convert to water, you know, the elixir of life, right? I'm going to have a drink right now. And actually, I think this is the truly revolutionary part of this movement, is the return to tap water. Think about it. You have all these overweight kids. We know that you can take a child, not change anything else in their diet, not change their exercise, get rid of the two sodas a day, substitute water, and they'll lose significant weight. Okay? I learned that from Kevin Strong, the Dunk the Junk doctor, if any of you know him. All right, so that's my overtime? No. So that's amazing, right? Imagine you wanted to reverse this epidemic. You would say, well, why don't we just put piping into all the homes and we could run water through it. We can put in faucets. People could put it in little bottles and carry it with them, right? We have the solution. Where can you tell people that, hey, you'll be thinner, you'll be richer, you'll live longer, you'll save the planet, and for the most part, the infrastructure exists, right? So this is what I think is the really revolutionary part of this, of where we really need to go. We're not really pushing Zevia as the alternative. We're certainly not pushing fruit juices, which we are not taxing. Really not taxing them in part because I don't think people are ready for it. And also there's some argument about them having some antioxidants. But, you know, eat your fruit. Don't drink your fruit. Think about how many apples it takes to make 8 ounces of apple juice, probably 3, 4, or 5. You can drink 2 of those down in a second. Can you eat 8 apples in a sitting? It's pretty tough, right? Nature was smart. Nature always put sugar with fiber, except in the beehive, but you had to fight the bees for that. That's the only place I can think of in nature. And the other sugar, lactose, is bound with protein. So none of the ways that we come across sugar normally in our day-to-day lives, if we eat from nature, does the liver get a huge bolus of fructose all at the same time. That's what's different about these. So, I'm supposed to talk about the nanny state. Well, you know, when people raise that, you know, why are you doing this after all? You're not my kid's parent. You know what my response is? For 30 years I was a cardiologist. I didn't know this. I didn't actually understand this. How could I expect the average parent to know this? I mean, the average parent didn't read that circulation article, right? So the other part of the nanny state is, let's face it, it's not an even playing field. I mean, you know, it's the real thing, right? I can still recite the Ipana toothpaste commercials from my childhood and the Pepsodent commercials, and they're not even on the market anymore, right? I mean, there are sophisticated people putting these things in our minds. So you can still help us. You can write letters to the editor. You can say, hey, why don't we do something like this in our city? and, you know, write us and we'll send you the ordinance. You know, start the conversation. But I think the ability to reverse the childhood obesity epidemic with one simple substitution, or to make a huge headway in it, and sugar-sweetened beverages are 43% of added sugar. Okay, so they are by far the largest concentration, and simple change. And I'll tell you one story, and then I'll end. In Richmond, we had the United States Tennis Association in an event on a Sunday because we resurfaced a bunch of tennis courts. And the head of Parks and Rec Commission ran up to me, African-American woman, gave me a big hug, said, "You'd be so proud of us. There's no sugar-sweetened beverages. We're serving, you know, flavored water. They put in a cucumber and a lime." And she's against the soda tax. You know, so I think it's going to be hard to put the genie back in the bottle. And, you know, those of you working in this, you know, let's join together and really push this. We're on the threshold in California of labeling GMO, and that can push GMOs out of our diet. And we are really, you know, big soda is now a big focus, like big tobacco was, and we can really push this and really make a huge change. And, I mean, everything they do would be legitimate if the product was okay. Just, you know, I mean, getting bigger market share, all these things that any business does. It's just when what you're peddling is, you know, so unhealthy that it becomes a problem. And that's just something that they haven't been able to face. So thanks so much. I'm honored to be here, and I think I'm going to come to your party next year.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I see there's a question there, and I wanted to also ask, and maybe the folks you brought with us can talk about this too. How do you deal politically with the argument that, you know, basically we're making this product more expensive for poor people, and that it's going to, you know, poor people don't want to do this because they don't want to pay extra money for this soda?
Well, I think, you know, we also have to point out that diabetes, heart disease, cancer, all of the leading causes of death in Richmond and in every city are really follow a health inequity, health disparity pattern. And, you know, I mean, I've been, you know, a big follower of the stress research and Michael Marmot's work and Wilkinson and Pickett. And I hadn't really looked so clearly at the, you know, the dietary part, but you realize that those communities are also the communities that are targeted for the advertising, and they're the ones that end up with, you know, with the worst health problems. So I think that's kind of what we need to explain, and also that there really are safe alternatives. I mean, you can flavor water, you can drink, you know, regular milk, you can dilute your juice. I mean, nobody has to really suffer. It is not a food. It is not essential. Well, in Richmond, we have Kaiser Richmond, and I worked there for 30 years, but nobody there really helped me at all, pretty much, because nobody felt, they were all sort of told not to speak out on it, and to be honest, none of the doctors there live in Richmond, hardly. Other people who are staff who work in Richmond and Kaiser have. At the county level, we've had support from the doctors. I think the county doctors just maybe tend to be more progressive in general. I think the most support we're really getting is from the people organizing the sports with the kids, the people who are doing urban agriculture, who would, you know, benefit, those who are progressive and can kind of see right off the top that, you know, this makes a lot of sense. I think that's, and, you know, the business community is basically against us. You know, this is going to hurt business, the Chamber of Commerce. But they're in bed with Chevron on everything all the time with Richmond. You know, anyway, we have a sort of alternative green business community, like Nutiva just moved to Richmond. They're not in the chamber. They gave me a contribution. They're very supportive. You know, it is an issue that really splits the community, and when 5 million gets poured in from the outside and you have a lot of people who need jobs, you know, it kind of distorts the process. Well, diet beverages aren't going to be taxed, and I'm not an expert on the data, but everybody asks that, so it always gets answered in forums that I'm at, and I can tell you what other people who know more than me have said. Well, I know for one thing, you know, I mean, what I've read about stevia looks pretty okay in terms of it having very little to no risk, because it's been used in somewhere in South America for 300 years and 30 years in Japan. And what people tell me is that sucralose is safe. But that there's this data that people who drink diet drinks tend to be overweight, and is it a chicken or the egg thing? Is it, well, they were overweight to start with, so that's why they're drinking diet drinks. And the critique is we have to get away from everything having to be sweet all the time, you know, and that just resets us to always being this sweet craving, and that if you're doing that with your diet drink, that perpetuates that. But I'm really not at all, you know, this other stuff, I can't say I'm an expert. I haven't done the research, but I've read all the research. I've probably read more of it than, you know, everybody in this room except maybe one or two people, you know. But about the diet stuff, I'm not. Yeah, it's an interesting breakdown because the soccer folks are a lot from the Latino community, and the 23rd Street merchants are from the, and a lot of these, you know, bodegas and stuff are in their community, and very easy to go to them and say, oh, you know, this is going to be a headache at the least, you know, vote no, right? What we've done on our side is we are developing the toolkit if it passes. How to comply. I mean, it's actually going to be, compliance is going to be going to a website and putting in your inventory. It's not going to be draconian or all that difficult. But we haven't spent the money to build the website yet. It's only been two grand because I can't justify the city spending the money unless it passes. You know, if I had it to do over again, maybe it would have been good to invest in all of that and show that toolkit early on and bring that around, but I think it would have still been hard. You know, I mean, if I'm a corner, one of these, you know, for me, it's going to, at the very least, it's an inconvenience. And, you know, you would have to be somebody who said, oh, yeah, I get it. This really helps our kids. Okay, it's inconvenient for me, but I'll do it anyway because it helps our kids. And it's hard to get people to that point. The other thing, let me just, I know I'm over, but we built a whole package, swimming lessons, whatever, what we can do with the 3 million. You know where it's very hard? I'm looking for the teaching the parents. And everywhere I go, they say, oh yeah, we have parenting classes, we have, you know, the school, but the wrong parents come in. It's always the parents that don't need it. It's, you know, we have a problem in those children who have so little support at home and how to help them. And, you know, and their parents are not easy to reach.
Ollie, go ahead, and then I'll ask, let you ask your question for Alex, and then we'll come back to Sophia and to see if there are other questions to wrap up on.
Right. From New York City, I was curious if in fact you're not able to get your tax, have you thought about the compromise that we've been working on, which is essentially getting rid of supersized bottles of sugary drinks?
Isn't it amazing you got sued anyway? Such a gentle thing. I've been on the phone with Howard Wolfson, your deputy mayor, and I've met in person with Mayor Nutter of Philadelphia. They've all had experiences. I don't have any, you know, ideas on going to the 16-ounce, you know, cutoff if this doesn't work. I haven't really thought that far, you know. But I'm thinking about what, you know, what interventions we need to do, win or lose. I mean, the day after the election's over, my view is this: we win it, we've got the wind at our back, we got momentum, we got $3 million to work with, we got Robert Wood Johnson in town, and we got a, you know, a bunch of you, you know, geniuses to help us. But we haven't solved anything. We lose, we don't have the wind at our back, we don't have Robert Wood Johnson, we don't have $3 million, we don't have you geniuses in town, but we still got to figure, we still have the same problem, you know, so we have to figure out an intervention strategy no matter what.
Thank you. And go ahead with your question for Alex.
There are a lot of questions there, so let's see. First Highland Hospital is our public hospital, one of 14 public hospitals left in California. The only public hospital in the entire state with a positive operating margin for the last 5 years. Thank you to the voters of Alameda County for the $75 million subsidy they provide through a half-cent sales tax for healthcare. Without it. Let's see. We're building a $700 million new facility, the largest capital program in the history of America, in the history of our county. And we're working really hard to position our public hospital for a post-reform healthcare economy where about 60% of its current volume will have choice. And in California, the public system, the safety net system, has not fared well in previous examples of choice. The most commonly cited is the labor and delivery market changes in the late 80s when we gave every pregnant woman access to Medicaid. And you saw a dramatic flight to the privates. Dr. Barbara Staggers, sort of great adolescent medicine African-American woman doc, once described it to me as Alex the white man's ISIS colder. And she referred to the phenomena of marginalized communities seeking care where they perceive more privileged communities to seek care. So I think there's just about in every analysis, the safety net is going to lose volume. We haven't yet seen one that says that publics can effectively compete with private hospital systems, particularly with the significant move under the exchange to private insurance for the uninsured. So I think that answered your Highland question. It's ours. It is the reason I gave that story about positioning for post-reform economy is the waiting room is an honest, true, excellent documentary. I highly recommend you all see it. And it actually doesn't help us better position the medical center for choice in a post-reform healthcare economy. It reinforces many of the realities, but also the negative stereotypes around one of the busiest level two trauma centers in the nation. I forgot what else you said. I kind of have a bone to pick with Oakland, and I want to say, as I said earlier, systems of oppression thrive when people who should be aligned are pitted against each other. That being said, I think there's no doubt that the way the city of Oakland managed the Occupy process was not only poorly administered, but a threat to public health and safety. And so the very quick story on the Occupy move, it happens to be the night, by the way, I don't know if you remember, but October 31st last year was the night we switched to a new ambulance provider after 40 years with the same ambulance provider. So we literally flipped the switch for our new ambulance company, and the first 11 calls at midnight Puerto Franca Agua Plaza. So the story of the Occupy stuff is that we said to the mayor and the city of Oakland that any public encampment in a city with significant poverty is going to attract a lot of homeless and mentally ill folks. And in our homeless count, in the very first night, we counted about 30% of the folks in the encampment being seriously mentally ill or homeless. By the end of the third week, that number was closer to 80%. We estimated over 225 of the 400 people who camped at any one time in that week were seriously mentally ill or homeless. And when you look at the 911 transit data and the other health problems, including sexual assault and shootings and killings, they were largely a function of a lack of public health investment. On the very first night of the Occupy encampment, we offered to bring in our two mobile federally qualified healthcare for the homeless clinics to set up a site right on Franco Agua Plaza. We were told by the city manager at that time that the answer was no. Their intent was not to make it hospitable for the encampment. Interestingly enough, on 10 a.m. of the morning that the encampment was first cleared out, the night where the most significant violence happened, we received a call from the city that said, "Oh yeah, can you come and be here by 1 p.m.?" In my naive-ish way, I was like, "Yeah, sure we can." And luckily, our staff were really smart, and they said, "No, Alex, we're doing our rounds. Both vans are booked all day long till 10 p.m. And besides which, why would they want us in within 3 hours when they said no before?" So, of course, at 7 p.m. that night, the police came in and rolled it out, and the mayor got on in front of the cameras at 8 p.m. that night saying, because of a public health emergency, the police had been called in. So we strongly disagree with how Oakland not only managed the crisis, but managed the public health implications of the crisis. Suffice it to say, they did change course. After clearing the encampment and then not securing the grounds and letting the encampment come back in, we were invited to be on site, and we were there for the next 17 days before the encampment was cleared again. We actually felt great cohesion and solidarity with many of the kind of arguments behind some of what happened at Occupy. The night that the Occupy encampment was actually disbanded finally happened after a meeting with our staff and the remaining Occupy protesters, where it became apparent it was no longer safe for the protesters to be on that site without adequate access to, frankly, law enforcement, because it was, at that time, it became over 80% of the folks who were camping there were mentally ill or homeless. Was that the question? Did I answer it?
Thanks. And unless there's another question out there, did somebody have their hand up? Oh, go ahead.
The state has found its hammer, managed care, right? 5 years ago, 80% fee-for-service, 20% managed care. By the end of next year, it's going to be 80% managed care, maybe even 90% if someone knows the data better than me, 10% fee-for-service. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, back when I was working for Children's Hospital and doing direct care, mental health work, I would have said managed care is immoral and unethical. What kind of business model works when you don't pay? That being said, the fee-for-service Medi-Cal program was like having a ticket to nowhere, right? The rates were so low, you couldn't get in. So responsibly, publicly accountable managed care, like the Alameda Alliance, a Brown Act compliant local initiative, works great because you get out of the box of rate setting that Medicaid sets. So you can pay higher rates to achieve network adequacy. So I'm actually kind of done a 180 on managed care, and I believe that when done appropriately and ethically, managed care is a really important tool for combating and addressing the low rates that Medicaid and Medicare currently pay. So in Alameda County, in my county, over 54,000 duly eligible Medi-Medis are moving into managed care. The problem is managed care has largely been a mamas and babies business, mostly healthy folks, with all respect to my managed care partners. So I believe that managed care is wholly and completely unprepared for the challenge of complex care, and particularly the SMR, the seriously mentally ill population. And we're already seeing it with the SPDs. Remember, last year, in my county, 24,000 seniors and persons with disability moved into managed care. And right now, beginning, I guess, in January or then in March, depending on what county you're in, another 50,000 in my county are going to move, 54,000 will move into managed care. And it's really forcing managed care plans to look at how they do business and their collaboration, particularly on the behavioral health side, with the local health authority, for whom managed care has been carved out since Medi-Cal consolidation happened in 1996. So just quick to sum up, the dual project faces huge challenges. That being said, things can't get better unless we change. So Toby Douglas, the state Medicaid director in California, has been given this impossible challenge, which is implement the Affordable Care Act with no money. Right? California, I think, now ranks last or next to last in state general fund. Our Medicaid cost per beneficiary is now under $5,000. In New York, Massachusetts, Vermont, over $12,000. So we've got a Medicaid program that has no state general fund and is taking on CCS reform, dual eligible reform, a MASH's expansion of managed care. So I applaud Toby and his team for their bravery. But I don't think that managed care is prepared to manage this population. And there's going to be some difficulties, potentially even some legal recourse that will need to be pursued.
Thank you. Well, I have another question for Sophia, and I'm sure people want to have questions for all our speakers. I wanted to ask her to talk a little bit about her experience with her adult medicine, her population, just in terms of adolescents' knowledge about their bodies and changes in attitudes about abortion. But I'm sensing a little bit that folks are getting ready for your next session. So let me invite people. We do have some silver ribbon pins and keychains here. If you'd like to come up and talk to any of our speakers, they can hang around for a few minutes. And I want to thank you again all for being here. I hope if you're heading back home to the East Coast at some point that your folks and your places are safe. And I want to thank very much our panelists for all their wonderful work and for some great presentations. So thanks very much.